Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 9th, 2005. Today's session is A History of Biblical Shoe Removal, Part 4, The Needy Lose Their Shoes, Amos 8. Presented by Dan Erlander, disc number 2005-04.
I don't have time to repeat it. A skeleton walked into a bar. By the way, the tape ministry we're starting. Skeleton walked into a bar and ordered a beer and a mop.
So that was a bare bones joke.
Bare bones joke. This is my straight man. We're going to look at Amos today. And Amos is not an easy book to read or teach, but I couldn't resist because it has an example of taking off sandals, one of the very few in the Bible. And if I were starting this over, it's interesting hearing once we completely forgot that the washing of the feet of the disciples, they would have all taken their sandals off. So that these are lessons not given this week. And anybody think of any others taking off sandals? So I think there's one other that we also forgot. But I'll remember that by tomorrow. Amos. I'll start right away. Did we have anything left from yesterday? Anything I forgot? So, if we did, it will come back. Then, this would be one review of the reminder of the wilderness way. And during the wilderness wandering for 40 years, and again, we ask the question, why did it take 40 years? You know, and the best guess is that the school in the wilderness plus the covenant making in the wilderness would take this long because it would be very difficult to remove the Egypt mind from the people and replace it with the mind of God's covenant.
You're also replacing the older generation with the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, according to Scripture, it took even in a second generation. And it reminds me of, there's a saying that it was easier for Moses to get the people out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of the people. And Egypt and the people was that the only way to have a community together is to have domination, hierarchy, a triangle where the very, very rich are at the top, the slaves are at the bottom, a religion that enforces the system, and then an army that enforces it if religion is failing. This is the Egypt way. And I remember years ago when Karen and I were in Namibia, and this was before independence, and we were standing with a Namibian pastor in front of the church, and if you've been to Africa, the image you have is just hundreds of people walking and walking to market, to wherever they're going. So these people were, a common scene is the woman carrying bags and something on her head and the man walking ahead of her with nothing. Which we copy that in less obvious ways, don't we? Or I do sometimes. But the pastor, and we were looking at these people walking by, and then the pastor said this spontaneously. He said, you know, it'll be much easier to get Namibia free from South Africa than to get South Africa out of the minds of the people. You know, it was almost the exact. And now, when we come to Amos, every lesson of the wilderness school that Moses taught has been forgotten. And Israel has become what Israel left, and that is Egypt. Do you get that? They begun what they left. And so the background now of where we are today with Amos, and by the way, we had a Bible study group in the church at home, and we went through the whole book of Amos, verse by verse by verse, and we got the giggles in the middle because there's nothing optimistic in this book. There's nothing. In fact, most of the prophets at least have some dream of a new day for these people. And Amos's word is only, it's too late, I'm just here to announce your destruction. And it ends with a word of hope about the future, which many scholars feel was added on to try to fix this depressing material that got into the Bible. So are you ready for this? This will be a depressing hour. And if you want to bail out. Okay, a little background on Amos. I don't have a timeline up there. So, I do a little one. The Israel after Solomon, and if you ever hear the phrase "wise as Solomon," have you heard that? I always think that was at the very beginning of his reign, because the reason there was a division into two kingdoms was because of the foolishness of Solomon. And that was, he was from the south, and he favored the south. The south got more money. The south got more benefits. The south had more power. And eventually it led to the division of Israel into two kingdoms. And this is in the 10th century BC. The two kingdoms are Judah in the south, and Israel in the north. And you see the division is here. Here's Israel in the north, Judah in the south. Judah and Jerusalem kept the line of David and their king. The north, a new dynasty began in the northern kingdom. Also it was taxes. Guess who got taxed more by Solomon? Yeah, guess who had to pay more? Guess who had to serve in the military in an unfair way? On and on and on. And so the two kingdoms, and now we're talking 200 years after the division of the kingdoms. Do you realize that we go through just little pieces of Bible history, and it's longer than the history of the United States? Isn't that amazing? So now, at the time of Amos in the 8th century BC, both the northern kingdom, capital Samaria, southern kingdom, capital Jerusalem, both were going through a period of unprecedented peace and prosperity. If there ever was a time when two nations had a chance to establish the way of the wilderness as a way to be a light to the nations, it was now. Egypt was weak. Syria was weak. Assyria had not gained power yet. So this was a period where little nations were free and not threatened. And also, massive amount of international commerce. And these two little nations were right in the right place, where all of the goods were going, Egypt up to the Fertile Crescent, back across, and both kingdoms just flourished under this. So these were what you would call the good old times. Did you get a picture of that? And so, but instead of using this time to live in a way of peace and prosperity, those who had the more power in both kingdoms took advantage of it to dominate and to exploit the poor people. And so we had one of the largest gaps probably between rich and poor in history.
The beginning of consumerism.
And that consumerism in some ways began with Solomon. You know, there's lists in the Chronicles about all of his possessions, you know, all of his ivory, all of his gold, all of his, it goes all the way down to his zoo, which included baboons, plus about 700 in his concubine, and how many wives, I forgot the number, but this was consumerism at its height. And that would have gone now into the period we're talking about, because in Amos he thunders against the rich with their summer and winter palaces. He thunders against the rich for all the ivory and the beautiful carved ivory that decorates their homes. Thunders against the rich for their gorgeous couches, that are filled with, I forgot to look this up in the dictionary, damask pillows, D-A-M-A-S-K.
That's not Danish, is it?
It's Norwegian.
I have this drawer full of damask tablecloths and
you do.
Napkins that we got as wedding gifts, you know, but they all have to be ironed.
Oh, yeah. Did you bring them on?
Thank you very much.
May I tell just one really short Norwegian? This is totally off the... it's about a group of Norwegian terrorists. And they... they hijacked a blimp. And so far, they have successfully bounced off of 5 buildings. Well, let's get back. Get back to the Bible. Well, and in chapter 4, Amos cries out against, and he isn't careful with his words. He calls the women of Israel or Samaria, sometimes called. He calls them the cows of Bashan, who lie on their couches. And then they call to their husbands to bring me another drink. This is how he talks. And then when there's an opportunity for shared wealth, the stronger now have grabbed the power and the wealth. And the poor are afflicted, exploited, and probably the most anti-covenant act was making money by driving the poor into debt, and then because the poor could not pay their debt, they had to pay with their bodies by being sold by the rich into slavery. This is low as you could get in terms of living as a covenant community. And so the poor are afflicted, and in 2 verse 7, their heads are trampled into the dust. Would someone read Amos 2, 6 to 8, and read it like a thundering prophet? Who do I have for a bond?
Thus says the Lord,
I hear. Wait.
Under your prophet.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you start, so right on, brother. Do you want to stand up? Thank you.
Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor of the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way. Father and son go to the same girl so that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. And in the house of their God, they drink wine brought with vines they opposed.
What do you think? Let's look at these accusations. By the way, I want to mention how something about Amos's preaching method. Because if the book kind of shows his preaching method, he starts out by just ripping into all the nations that are around the northern kingdom. He rips into, says, the Lord roars from Zion, and then the prophet roars against all the sins of Damascus, all the sins of Gilead, all the sins of Gaza, all the sins of Edom, all the sins of Ekron, all the sins of Tyre, and then even the Amorites, Rabbah, which is now Ammon, Jordan, raves against their wickedness. And then you can just see the people of the northern kingdom say, right on, Amos, give it to them. These are all our enemies. Yeah, give it to them more. Let's hear more of your sermons. Then you come to chapter 2 when the prophet has their ear and turns it on them. Wow. Try this, pastors, here sometime. Just raving or preach against all the things and people and groups that most of your people are against. Can we try that? And then turn it around. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Selling the poor into slavery because of debt. And also it would include bribing the judges. The only recourse the poor would have was to go to the elders at the gate to seek a judgment out of the Mosaic law in their favor. But the judges at the gate had been bribed by the rich, so the poor had no recourse. And that's why in the Psalms so often you hear the cry of the poor to vindicate us, for only in you is our help. Then a creditor may sell a man into slavery even because of a trivial debt. Now, think of a household that is struggling even to have enough food, and then the father of the household is sold as a slave and then is taken away to another country. Now, what we're going to find here more and more in the book of Amos, that those who were responsible or supportive of this had no feeling, no compassion, no sense of what it would be like to be them. It was only to gain for themselves. Now, what about the shoes? A creditor may sell a man into slavery because of trivial debt. And then they set up this phony ritual. And remember when so-and-so gave his sandal to Boaz? And this this was a symbol, a ritual of the transfer of property. And now the poor person has to take off his sandal and give it to the rich person who has driven him into debt. And this is the symbolic thing to make it look like it's legitimate. And so here we have, again, similar to in Boaz and what's his name? The so-and-so. We have the giving of the shoe, of the sandal. Now, notice in the passage that we just read that the Amos preaches it both against personal morality, what we would call personal morality, and social immorality. And again, this, the heartlessness of this is one, a father and son take a woman of the poor who is a prostitute or who has been forced into prostitution, and they both have intercourse with the same girl the same night at the temple near the altar, and where they do their act is on top of a garment from the poor that has been given to them as collateral for debt. Do you follow this? So, but now as the covenant law commands, instead of giving that garment back to the poor person for the night, so that person has a blanket to sleep for the night, they have it in their special place of immorality. So, are you getting the picture that this society is in trouble? No. Also, what else? I guess that's some of the background. Now, what Amos cries for is justice and righteousness. If you turn to chapter 5, here is chapter 5, 21 through 24. Would someone read that again? And here the prophet is speaking for God or for Yahweh. 21 through 24.
I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps, but let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an overflowing stream.
Can you hear the music?
Yeah.
Justice. This famous verse of calling for justice to flow down like water. And if you live in the desert, now that is a sight, to see water just flowing and flowing, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream, not a wadi. Did I say that right? Wadi. The rivers that are dry most of the year but have some water in them during the rainy season. Let justice flow down and righteousness like an everlasting stream. Let's just look for a minute at these two words. This is going to be a faint attempt to write Hebrew words on the board, but justice is mishpat, and it has some scribblies on top. If you're a Hebrew scholar here, you're cringing. And you can help me with the dots if someone is good at that. But, or should we just go on?
Yes.
And the word for righteousness is tzedakah. They're very much twin words, almost interchangeable. And justice is always to remember, we have narrowed the meaning of justice in our country to mostly what, like criminals getting their due.
And Michael we have, Jackson.
What's that?
Michael Jackson, that's justice.
Yeah, did he?
That's the question.
Get all excited, I think.
I have no idea.
That's justice working. But to the Hebrew, justice, mishpat, was a whole community, or as Martin Luther King would say, the beloved community, where all the resources are shared, all have enough, all have dignity, all have a place. And then to add to that, tzedakah, righteousness. Again, righteousness has been narrowed in our society, I think, to being moral. Is that close? So, and righteousness, the best help I ever got on this word was once in a little group with Joseph Sittler, who probably some of you knew or know, that was one of the great Lutheran theologians of the last century at University of Chicago. And I remember we sat in this little living room of a campus center and just had 2 hours to just talk. And he told this story about a trip he had Israel, and he was had a free day, so he borrowed a car and was driving to some sites. And in one town, Palestinian town, his car broke down, and he managed to get it to a garage. It broke down close to a garage where there was a Sabra mechanic, meaning Sabra is a born in Israel, Israeli-speaking person. It's a mechanic. So he left it there and went for a walk, and he came back, and the bonnet was open. And when he came back, the engine was running, and it was running perfectly, perfectly. And so he and the mechanic did what men do. You have a hood open and you both stand and look at the engine. Yeah, it's fun. So, but then the engine running perfectly, he heard the Sabra Jewish man just say with great joy one word, tzedakah. And he said, "Will you say that again?" And then he realized that is a biblical word for righteousness. It is the whole beloved community where every part is working for the good of the whole, and every part is working for the good of the rest. Everything is working together. That is righteousness. And I was so excited once when I was down in San Diego at a church that's one block from the beach, and the pastor was a surfer. Can you think of a better combination? And really had a ministry among surfers because he was surfing every day. He was also a good pastor. He noticed when he got there, when the perfect wave would come, and when the surfer was just completely connected to that wave, so would come in without a flaw in a beautiful, beautiful pattern. And then the surfers would say, "Righteous." They would call it a righteous wave. And we, Pastor Dave and I just said, "Oh, that's it, they got it." And notice how broken it was in Israel or Samaria. at the time of Amos. So that is a prayer for justice and for righteousness. And then the result is shalom. Shalom. And well, moving right along. Now, I want to just finish. The official high priest in Bethel, and Bethel was right on the border, and this was the official worship site for the northern kingdom. They no longer had Jerusalem. They had this official worship site. Sorry. And then, do you think the high priest there was amused at this quaint prophet who, by the way, this quaint prophet wasn't even from the northern kingdom? He was from Tekoa, way down here, 6 miles southeast of Bethlehem. And he was not a trained preacher. He was not an official prophet of any shape or form. He was a keeper of sycamore trees and a shepherd. And he was called to go up to the north to proclaim their sinfulness. Do you think they liked him?
They welcomed him with open arms.
Oh yes, at last someone has come to tell us the truth about ourselves. So the high priest of the temple site there met Amos and says, and first of all, he reports this to Jeroboam II, who I'm sure also wasn't amused. And to Amos, go back to Judah. We don't want you. Go earn your salary there. Go there and get paid to be a preacher. Get out of our country and never again preach at Bethel, for it is the king's sanctuary. Do you think there was a separation of church and state? The king's sanctuary. And Amos proclaimed to him, I am no prophet. I'm a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees. And Yahweh sent me here. Ooh, Yahweh sent me here. And then he preaches to the high priest. And just says very, very kind of gentle things like, your future is bleak. You will be destroyed. Your wife will become a prostitute. Your sons and daughters will die. Your land will be parceled out, and you will die in a foreign land. Real cheery. This is the situation, and I want to just read one or two other passages and then make some comments and then have our discussion here. Some of the more pithy passages here. Did we read, I am lost. Oh yeah, this... the one thing I didn't mention in this, let justice flow, the phrase, take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. These people, with all their exploitation of the poor, they had very, very competent worship committees who planned the worship and the ritual very, very well. And so there it says, I hate, I despise your festivals. And then another is in chapter 8. Hear this, you that trample on the needy and bring to ruin the poor of the land. And then you say, when will the new moon be over so we may sell grain and the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale? In other words, I can't wait till this boring worship service is over so I can get back to exploiting the poor. And then they even say how they do it. We will make an ephah small and a shekel great. This was changing the size of the measuring cups so the poor pay more and get less grain. We will practice deceit with false balances, buying the poor for silver and the needy for sandals. That's where we get back to that. But it is cheating. And then selling the sweepings of the wheat. And that was, if the wheat were was in a basket, the top wheat would just look perfect, but inside it would mix all kinds of chaff with the wheat. So then when the poor got home, they realized again they had been cheating. What did I say?
Chaff.
Oh. And they've been chafted.
Oh, I see. They've been chafted. Clever. Clever. And then, so. Let's see if there's one other in chapter 8. No, I think you get the message. And so what I'd like to... to say here we have a total breakdown of the beloved community and crying out of Amos that this nation will be destroyed. When you live this way with each other, all that can happen to you in the future is your destruction. And then Amos announces that that destruction will come and says nothing about if you repent and change your ways, it will not. He is only there to announce it will come. So, now I would like to just tell two little things, stories, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, the first one is about Bob Riley. Bob Riley is the governor of Alabama. And Bob Riley is a conservative Christian and is a very dedicated conservative Christian. One of his staff members, no, not a staff member, a teacher at Beeson University, which is there, which is a Southern Baptist university, took a sabbatical and studied the Old Testament and the covenant that comes from the wilderness and from Moses. And there she read her Bible and read about things like we've been talking about justice for the poor, about all the systems of keeping the poor from falling, about a society that takes care of its most vulnerable, widows, orphans, and sojourners, and how this is the will of God and it's in the Bible. Oh, this is real hope, you know, people love the Bible so much, maybe they'll read it, including myself. So she wrote a paper on this as her sabbatical project. And it was printed in the Birmingham newspaper, her paper. And then it was read by the governor. And all of a sudden he realized that our state, Alabama, that has the most regressive tax system of any of the states in the United States, and also the poor are not cared for, the schools are crumbling, and he is converted to the biblical way of living together as a society. And what Bob Riley does then, and this is just a year or two ago, He was especially disturbed that the poor paid such a larger percentage of their income to state taxes than the rich. He proposed a wholesale restructuring of the state's tax system based on justice, biblical justice, reducing taxes on the poor and middle class, and then raising taxes on corporations and the rich. So when the vote came, over 60% of the people of Alabama voted against it, and it lost. The reason being mainly that the corporations, and especially the timber industry, and the wealthy of Alabama mounted such an effective campaign of misinformation and scare tactics that the people voted against themselves. But that's discouraging, but what is encouraging is what could happen if people really read the Bible in this country and not just read the passages that we all agree with, and I'm speaking to me and us also. So that was the result. I'd like to say the very rich left on the way to the bank, and then we continue to sing, let justice roll down like the waters, and righteousness like an ever-rolling stream. Now, this is really where now I move into a territory of which I know very little about. And that is economics. So I haven't done much with economics since I handed the whole family budget and checkbook and everything over to Karen after running up a deficit. Sizable deficit. There's let's see where I have it from one thing I forgot to look at. But, I'll forget about it. It's an article that I read called The Tax Cut Con by Paul Krugman. Are some of you familiar with Paul Krugman, who writes economics for the New York Times? And he talks about the usual things that we've heard about, as I have in this little chart here. This is only through 98. This is before Bush. But between that time, the bottom 40% of our country lost I forgot what they lost. Until I'm really up my field. You get to the middle class, it was the gain of family income over this period. And they lost 76.3%, and then you just go up into the top 1%, it's a gain of 42.2%. Now, so you have this usual, but what he says in this article is that we are in a planned crisis. And one of the most eloquent people that writes about this is Grover Lindquist. Have you heard of Grover Lindquist? Very, very influential, but has no office. But every Tuesday morning, a meeting of the real movers and shakers in the economy meet with him to make plans. And his famous quote, maybe you have heard, someone asked if he wants to destroy the government, and he said he doesn't want to destroy the government. He just wants to shrink it until it's so small he can put it into his bathtub and push it down the drain. That's colorful. Here is what, if I can just briefly say this. One is the concealing of the amount of the tax cuts go to the privileged in our country. And this is done by things like the extent of the tax cuts with their sunset clauses. The reduced top income tax, and then eliminating the estate tax. And part of this plan was to really convince Americans that the estate tax was really hurting family farmers and small businessmen. You know, and it just isn't. I heard Bill Gates' father talk about this. Who's very, very convinced that we need the estate tax. And he said that he and his people called every farm bureau region in the entire United States, and they did not find one example of an ordinary family farmer losing a farm because of the estate tax, because concerns like the top 3% of people in wealth. Do you follow what I mean in my stumbling way? But then it was convincing to most people that this is hurting the regular person. And therefore, the other plan is to create in this country tax hatred, to make the mood of the country so angry about taxes that a tax hike becomes impossible. You know, when we are so lower in our taxes, even if we complain about them, so much lower than, I think ours is something like 24% local, state, federal, and Canada's is something like 38%. You notice how precise I am when I get into economics. Then blowing up the amount of tax help that the middle class and poorer people got in this last, and he really thinks it's a planned crisis, and this is how it works, and this either is close to the truth or it's paranoia. Mm-hmm. So that's for us to decide about Paul Krugman. But this is the way it works, that first of all, you have a debt that makes it impossible to increase any government help or government programs. And then, but the government must pay its bills, so something has to be cut. So the very, very necessary things still carry on, but they are cut. And then something has to give, because then we have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And to make a long story short, if you want to read this article, but to make a long story short, the dream of a is for a restructured America that goes back to before the passing of Social Security. And when basically, if you lose, you're on your own. Or it's the charities of churches that are going to pick up the pieces. And years ago I heard that if churches were going to support all those who fall and need help, every congregation in the entire United States would have to contribute over $70,000. That includes that little Baptist church down the street with, in Minnesota, with 50 members. So the dream is a society where the rich prosper, the ones that can make it prosper, and then to be like so many third world countries, those underneath who fall, we don't care about. It's their own problem. And if there's some good people that want to try to take care of them, that's up to them. And he closes with this, what kind of country do we want in the future? Well, I know that's inadequate, but then to bring it back to Amos again, is the problem of the time of Amos is those who were exploiting, getting richer and getting richer, have no sense of heart or tenderness or compassion or feeling with those who were the losers. And in the biblical tradition, this causes Yahweh God to weep and to cry, and then finally to side with the poor, and eventually the rich lead the country to destruction, as they did in the Northern Kingdom first. The Assyrians came, and then in the Southern Kingdom, the Babylonians came, and they were not healthy enough to figure out a way to live with these great empires. So the end was catastrophe. And then we love our country, I'm assuming most of you are Americans. If you're Canadian, you love your country too. We love it and want the best for the future. And I like to stand with Bill Riley, who read the scriptures, read the prophets, and say, we are sinning as a nation, and we must change. So that is the taking off of the shoe in Amos. Oh, I'm sorry, did I go that long? Okay, let's talk. I wanted to have 15 minutes for...
Getting back to the question from the other day, who are other prophets among us, other than this Bill Riley, even though what he wanted didn't succeed?
Yeah,
one is Peter Peterson, conservative, relatively conservative from an economic standpoint, that was in the Reagan administration, who has written a book called Running on Empty. I recommend it to anybody. That really lays out, I think, the picture of what you were talking about. Probably not from the standpoint of the insidiousness of Grover Norquist and others that are trying to intentionally drive the system to the bottom, but he really lays the blame on both parties and lays out a prescription for a possible change. But he does it from the standpoint of being really moved by what we are doing to the coming generations, that we are so selfish that we're not even looking forward to what our kids or grandkids are doing.
We all, through our representatives just a few weeks ago, passed the credit reform legislation, which I guess to me seems like it makes it very much more difficult for people to get out from under a crushing debt load, makes them set up a repayment plan over many number of years. It seems to me like that's just about the closest you can get in this country to putting somebody into slavery and confiscating their labor.
This is a recent bankruptcy. Yeah, and the spin that was put on it that was going to stop frivolous, But isn't it over half of people that are bankrupt? It's because of lack of health insurance and medical emergencies.
Things they have no control over.
See, it's again an example of just the heartlessness of, you know, of
meanwhile, big corporations who are going through bankruptcy can dismiss the payments to their retirees. Mm-hmm. That also just happened in several cases. United Airlines, for example.
Yeah. Yep.
This past weekend, Jim Wallace and the Call for Renewal and the Bread for the World and a couple of other organizations were in Washington, D.C. Lobbying for the moral issues of hunger and health and homes. So it seems like that's a positive light, trying to switch the moral talk to the poor. Mm-hmm. And they worshiped at the National Cathedral. I don't imagine with the news. I was here, so I never saw it, but I don't imagine the media ever picked it up.
But in a way, Jim Wallace is a prophet.
Yes.
And also, he's a loving prophet because you always feel like he wants the very, very best and just doesn't want to tear down our country. And also to bring together what's commonly called the name morality with social justice. And notice how Amos was concerned about both.
And Jim Wallace has his book out that was on the bestseller list for a few weeks, God's Politics. Mm-hmm.
And the hopeful part on his book tour, which really has turned out to be almost a national referendum, he has moved across the country with thousands of people coming to these book tour, which is essentially almost turned into large gatherings of people across the country. And he has a study guide with that book that enables people to start in that process.
Yeah. I want to ask you if there's someone here that just thinks, you know, what I tried to share was off base and I was being influenced by leftists, etc., or certain take. I hope in the Holden Village would be free to just share all opinions in a way.
But Dan, and some Republicans as well. David Brooks is a Republican, a fine thinker, and he ran a piece in the New York Times and said the Republican Party is just going to have to make a decision about where its values are. And he went on to show that the traditional argument that there is mobility in the United States, that everyone has the opportunity to move up, has been the defense of inequalities. And Brooks said that hasn't happened for 20 years. It's stagnant in terms of this.
Or just like charts like this.
And then the New York, and so Brooks was pointing to something that has now come out in this series on class in America in the New York Times, and the one on Sunday, which I didn't see, I only read Monday's paper about it because it already got a raft of letters to the editor. People don't want to talk about class and class war in the United States. The one on Sunday was the very rich are leaving the rich behind. And so it's not just the standards now in the middle class, but even the rich are keeping up with the very rich. It's, the inequalities are spreading. So you get people like David Brooks who are committed Republicans, heart and soul, also worried.
There's another Republican that was in the Nixon administration that has been one of the leaders in naming this discrepancy between rich and poor, but I forgot.
Kevin Phillips.
Kevin Phillips.
Book after book.
Kevin Phillips and
servants. I've read that the evangelical influence on this administration is putting it oversimplified, is that, well, the end of the world is coming soon, so why try?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a, it's a dangerous idea.
Yeah.
It's more prevalent than we'd like to. I want to, well, let's take tomorrow, should we take the first 10 minutes and just any more sharing on this before we get into the answer, taking your shoes off with St. Francis. But I want, this is a little story. When we lived in Tacoma, went down to Olympia to hear Howard Zinn speak. And he has written the book, People's History of the United States, where he tells the history of the United States from the standpoint of the underclass or the powerless. It's very, very interesting. So I was interested in hearing him. And so I went down there and was in this church social hall that was just jammed with every left-wing radical in three counties. The energy there, and I was dressed about like this, and I was the most well-dressed person there, and you could just feel the energy in this room. And Howard Zinn started speaking and eloquently, and I just felt a discomfort in the room, you know. But, and then it came out during the question and answer period. And there was this anger, you know, why aren't you screaming against, I forgot who was president, it was a Republican, and they had all come there to hear him just scream about how bad things are. And he didn't. So when they pushed him on it, it's almost like he was standing on tiptoes looking at the eastern horizon, you know, waiting for the sun to come up. And it was an Advent moment. And he said, I have written and studied all the great movements in the United States. He says, I have studied the labor movement. I have studied the women's suffrage movement. I've studied the civil rights movement. What other movements could you name? And he says, I've studied what went before them. And he said, I'm optimistic because all over the United States, there's little groups of people that are banding around these issues. And he said, they're all going to come together. And I just went out of there. Wow, I hope he's right. But he likened it to the time so many years before the civil rights movement really broke. And do we trust that maybe it will be total catastrophe, but our prayers and our trust, is God still moving? And is God, in our faith statement, to say, is God is forming networks and groups all over this country. And I want to believe that. And I want to continue to pray for that in our nation, that something new, a new day will dawn. But then there'll be more problems. So I say, go in peace to walk in circles. I wish I could stay up.